approximately an hour, and we'll end at 3 o'clock. I'd like to read just a few comments about Eugene England and Valerie M. Hudson, if I may. Eugene England is professor of English literature at BYU and teacher of the family history writing class in his Provo, Utah ward. He is married to Charlotte Hawkins England, and they have 6 children and 9 grandchildren. His most recent books are Converted by Christ by the Book of Mormon, edited with Dennis Clark, Harvest, Contemporary Mormon Poems, and Beyond Romanticism, Tuckerman's Life and Poetry. He writes personal essays, poetry, and criticism of American and Mormon literature and Shakespeare. He is presently at work on a book on the poet Leslie Norris and on Shakespeare, and is editing a collection of Mormon stories. Valerie M. Hudson is Director of Graduate Studies at the David M. Kennedy Center for International and Area Studies and Assistant Professor of Political Science at Brigham Young University. She has received her doctorate from the Ohio State University and has previously taught at Northwestern University and at Rutgers University. Her specialties include American national security policy, comparative foreign policy, political psychology, and social science methodology. She currently serves as a member of the Executive Committee of the International Studies Association. I'd like to present Professor Eugene England and Professor Valerie M. Hudson.
Thank you, Rick. Of course, in the usual physical sense, we didn't lose the Gulf War. Our armies advanced. Much of Iraq's army was destroyed. Saddam Hussein surrendered, and he is now, to some extent, at the mercy of UN forces. It is the spiritual sense of winning and losing I wish to explore, the sense indicated when Christ said, "Fear not them which kill the body, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell." I believe our fear of the physical dangers of Saddam Hussein, his ability to kill the body, led us to actions and attitudes that endanger our souls, that put us more in the power of the devil. I'm not an expert in international relations, so I will not couch my argument mainly in terms of an attempt to assess what we have lost and endangered politically through our decision for violence in the Gulf, though I think the evidence is now quite strong that there were few, if any, political gains and perhaps great long-term political losses. Nor will I attempt to predict in specifics what the consequences of the Gulf War will be for international relations. My article in Sunstone last fall about why we should not fight Iraq indulged in some such political analysis and prophecy, and of course I made some mistakes. And some have used those errors as a reason to dismiss the rest of my argument. So let me focus on some areas where I am an expert and can speak with some authority. That is, in attempting to understand how violence of any kind works and how to avoid it, given by the scriptures and by our greatest literature and literary criticism. The example of Christ, which is our most authoritative standard, more authoritative than the Old Testament, as well as his teachings and those of modern prophets, are absolutely and consistently clear about the highest Christian ethic concerning response to evil in the world. We are, in Christ's words, to resist not evil. Or in the words of Paul, be not overcome of evil, but overcome evil with good. That might serve as the perfect motto for the active pacifism I have tried to describe and defend. Overcome evil with good. It has been disconcerting to find many of my critics accusing me of pacifism, advocating doing nothing, rather than the pacifism I find in Christ, which is extremely active. Christ doesn't say, ignore your enemies and they'll go away. He says, love your enemies, do good to them that hate you, and despitefully use you. And in 1976, President Kimball clarified for us what that can mean in any situation of conflict. Take the gospel to your enemies, that they may no longer be your enemies. I believe that means not only literally preaching the gospel when you can, but living the gospel of the Prince of Peace in all your relationships, actively giving, setting an example, teaching, yes, but also sacrificing our lives for others to avoid the evil of violence against them. I believe it means active pacifism, something which has only been practiced twice in our century that I know about and has been enormously successful both times. I mean the Marshall Plan, where victors gave the means to defeated enemies to rebuild their nations, thus making them into continuing friends, and Anwar Sadat's courageous making of peace with Israel, by giving in, accepting the humiliation of going to Israel to speak to the Knesset, and eventually paying with his life, as his own people, who could not accept such humiliation, killed him. Other than these two examples, both successful, modern nations have refused to live the gospel in their conflicts with other nations, but instead have practiced some form of realpolitik, all forms of which are based in some version of the absolutely unchristian principle that might makes right and that force will bring about good results. Even enlightened realpolitik, in my view, moves us onto the devil's ground. I don't believe there's a middle ground. Some who have written critiques of my work to me have suggested there is a classical reactionism which Israel practices and others of always responding to force with force. There is classical pacifism, which never does, but there's some kind of middle position which we can and should practice of limited force. I don't believe there's a middle position. I think that there are forces of eternal law which violence always unleashes, any kind of violence, and that they produce more harm than good. As James O'Day from Amnesty International, from his broad experience in many countries in the world, stated it yesterday, violence, by its very nature, seems to always want to mirror itself. And it's true, although I think I would add to that, it usually does more than mirror itself. It always escalates. I might mention just for a bit a modern literary critic, René Girard, who has produced, I think, the most interesting theory of human violence. And his own life odyssey is an interesting evidence of the power of his insight. He began studying ancient mythologies and literatures and gradually came to the conclusion that every society begins in violence and it erects its religion and its literature around the attempts to mask what it does about violence. But that the processes he revealed are inevitable and can be traced throughout all literature, including the Bible. He claims that the Bible is a true book and that Christ is the Savior, a conclusion he came to, apparently, on the basis of his study of it in terms of violence, that it is the only book in the world that consistently attempts to and finally succeeds in revealing the violence in all cultures and in all of us, and what the only solution to it is, and that is Christ's rejection of violence as a response. I think he's right. And a simple thought experiment, I think, reveals our intuitive understanding of this. Imagine, if you will, any of your experiences with your siblings growing up or your children. If one accidentally strikes another or hurts another, or say they're playing a game and something happens where one feels hurt, what's the natural reaction? To strike back. But because of our inborn and ingrained sense of justice, the striking back is always just a little bit harder. And then, of course, the original party does what? Whatever their intention, innocent or not, they realize that they have been dealt with unjustly, because at least the blow was harder than the one they struck, and so they strike back. That sounds childish, and it is childish, but if you think about it a bit, it's the story of every conflict in history, including the Gulf War. René Girard's point is that until we stop responding with escalation and scapegoating, choosing alternative people to turn to wreak our violence upon if we're faced with a force too powerful, we will never solve violence. I think he's right. And as soon as we enter into that ground with any form of realpolitik, no matter how moderate, I think we've begun to unleash those inevitable forces. There are, I believe, only two ways to respond to evil. Of course, violence always begets violence, except in the case of Christ and those who are willing to follow him. The remarkable thing about Christ is that he did not respond with violence. He did not allow himself to be scapegoated. He did not say, "I deserve this," as Oedipus Rex does. He says, "I don't deserve it, but I still will not respond with violence." Girard's point, I think it's the point of the scriptures, is that's the only way. And until we are willing to adopt that way, we will not stop violence. And as long as we're unwilling to, we are essentially in the devil's territory. There are only two ways to respond to evil and aggression and injustice in the world: Christ's way of active pacifism, overcoming evil with good, and all other ways that depend on force or even intimidation, no matter how carefully measured or controlled they try to be. Modern prophets have constantly reminded us of this reality. 1938, as Hitler increased his belligerence and demands, Hubie Brown praised the efforts of Chamberlain to keep the peace through negotiations and gave as a major reason war has never settled anything satisfactorily. In discussing the challenges posed by World War II in April 1942, right after the U.S. entered the war, the First Presidency stated unequivocally, "There is an eternal law that rules war, and all those who engage in it, whether righteous or not, force always begets force." President McKay, in the same conference, stated unequivocally, "War is incompatible with Christ's teachings. It is vain to attempt to reconcile war with true Christianity." Christ teaches clearly, and it is confirmed throughout the Scriptures, that there is only one way to peace, and that is through doing good, by acting nonviolently upon principles of love. He also teaches clearly, and all history bears him out, that force, even in the highest cause, that of justice and freedom, always produces counterforce, destroys peace, and produces legacies of continuing hatred and violence. The choice was stated clearly by Hamlet as he faced the dilemma of how to respond to the evil committed by his uncle in killing Hamlet's father and taking over the kingdom of Norway. To be or not to be, that is the question. The speech is not, as those inclined to approve of revenge have interpreted it, about whether to be courageous and take revenge or to be a coward and commit suicide. Hamlet explains in exact parallel in the next sentence exactly what he means. Whether to be or not to be means whether to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune or to take arms against the sea of troubles and by opposing end them. The choice is between suffering the world's evil or taking revenge upon the perpetrators of evil, to be or not to be. Shakespeare is restating a medieval position that our very being, our existence, the content and quality of our being as real people and children of God depends on our patient acceptance of God's world and obedience to his way of dealing with its misfortunes. That is, through patience and enduring love, as opposed to the growing Renaissance position that we should actively seek justice in the world even by opposing evil forcefully with arms. The reason not to be is a good description of that second alternative. The reason that as soon as he says it, Hamlet starts to think about death is not that he is contemplating suicide, but that he knows perfectly well that if he takes arms against Claudius, he will himself likely be killed, either by the king's guards or friends or relatives who will in turn want to take revenge on him. One reason taking revenge destroys our being, as Shakespeare clearly shows, is that it leads us to mistake the nature of evil, deludes us into thinking that evil can be identified with one person or group and destroyed if we can destroy that person or group. President Bush began this process early in the Gulf crisis, calling a man he had been sending aid and arms to just a few months before a Hitler, somehow a unique source of evil because he had invaded another country, as if many other countries, including the United States, had not been doing just that in recent years. Democratic Congressman Solars, speaking during the debates just before Bush began the war, put it this way, "Evil is loose on the earth, and it must be stopped." Shakespeare carefully shows in the first part of the play that Hamlet's father has killed the father of Fortinbras of Norway, who wants to take revenge. In fact, Shakespeare shows us during the gravedigger scene that old Hamlet did this on the day Hamlet was born, explicitly connecting Hamlet into the continuing cycles of fathers being killed and people taking revenge. One of the sins that Hamlet's father's ghost admits he is repenting of is likely that killing. And as the play continues, we see that old Hamlet is not so different from his brother Claudius as Hamlet would like us to believe, and that, in fact, Hamlet becomes increasingly like Claudius as the play progresses, for instance, doing exactly to Rosencrantz and Guildenstern what Claudius wants to do to him. Dostoevsky and the brothers Karamazov suggest in the Grand Inquisitor scene that one of the chief wiles of the devil is to convince us that he doesn't exist. I think an even more subtle wile is for him to convince us, as he apparently did President Bush and Congressman Solars, that he exists in the form of one man or one group, and that if we can just get rid of them, we will get rid of the devil and evil, rather than realizing that evil is in all of us. And that the more we embark on that process of trying to get rid of it by killing or violently dealing with it, the more we become exactly like the persons we are engaged in violence against. Shakespeare shows throughout, and it's one of the points that Girard makes from his analysis of mythologies through history. The more people engage in violence with each other, the more they become doubles, exact reflections of each other. Most clearly parallel, he kills someone's father, just as his was killed, only in this case it is Polonius, the father of Ophelia, and of Laertes, who, exactly like Hamlet, and with just as good reason, wants revenge, and eventually gets it upon Hamlet. At the end of the play, the stage is piled with corpses, a direct result and perfect image of the consequences of engaging in violence, no matter how justified. I think one of the reasons this play is so difficult is because it's so morally powerful if we think about it. I've talked about, in my criticism, the bandwagon effect. Shakespeare, in a number of his plays, poses a very difficult moral situation, and our natural emotional response is to be on the side of the avengers. It's true in The Merchant of Venice. We hate the Jew. We love to hate the Jew. And we're all caught up in getting revenge on him. In Twelfth Night, we hate Malvolio. He deserves what he's going to get. But at a certain point in each play, including Hamlet, I think Shakespeare clearly intends the moral reader to say, this has gone too far. I must get off this bandwagon. And if the person is reflective enough, begins to think, I never should have gotten on this bandwagon. And Hamlet is a difficult case because Claudius is a slime. And Shakespeare shows what a slime he is in the language he gives us. We feel his evil from the very beginning. But that's exactly his point. It's a simple case if he can show us that revenge is not deserved against a good person or a mistaken problem. But to show that even against what seems to us a just cause, it's wrong, is his point, I believe. As Hugh Nibley has clearly shown, the Book of Mormon does not, as it is so often interpreted, contradict Christ's call to pacifism by justifying the Nephite wars against the Lamanites, even in self-defense. In his great chapter in Since Gomorrah on good people and bad people, he demonstrates that even though the usual assumption, both by the Nephites and by us, is that the Nephites were good guys and the Lamanites bad guys, in actuality, the only reason there was war was because both were bad. Again and again, the Lord tells the Nephites and us that if they were righteous, they would have no trouble with the Lamanites. This is demonstrated in the positive sense, of course, when the sons of Mosiah go on a mission among them. These hated, despised people, these evil incarnate, as much as the Iraqis have become to us. And they become the most righteous people in the Book of Mormon. They are converted in large numbers. And, of course, some of them become the people of Ammon. Demonstrating perfectly and fully President Kimball's point that the only way to deal with enemies is to take the gospel to them so they will no longer be our enemies. And the editor Mormon says of the people who in fact did live by Christ's command against violence, the anti-Nephi Lehis, Lamanites converted by Ammon who allowed themselves to be slaughtered rather than kill others, that there had not been so great love in all the land, even among the Nephites, as these people thus showed. I think the point clearly is if the Nephites had been capable of such love, they could have lived the laws of Christ's ultimate ethic and would have achieved the same result without violence. These people of Ammon also showed that active pacifism can stop violence, as their sacrificial restraint moved the Lamanites to stop killing them and actually converted many to Christ. A less dramatic example, but perhaps one more pertinent to today, when we remember the great cry of anti-communism. Do you remember? Better dead than red, right? All believe that? It may surprise Mormons especially that a Book of Mormon hero Gideon advises just the opposite. In Mosiah 20, when the priests of Noah abduct some Lamanite maidens and thus bring the wrath of the Lamanites upon the people of Limhi, who have been living in peace with the Lamanites, how? By paying tribute. Gideon advises Limhi to let the Lamanite king, whom he has captured, go and try to make peace. Let us pacify the king, and we fulfill the oath of tribute which we made unto him, for it is better that we should be in bondage than that we should lose our lives. Therefore, let us put a stop to the shedding of so much blood. Shakespeare shows us how difficult it is to follow the Christian ethic of no violence or revenge. Hamlet, despite his intelligence, his sure knowledge of the probable consequences, his moral intelligence even, and his full awareness of the dangers to his soul, if the ghost is evil and counseling him wrong, still chooses not to be. He laments that conscience, that is our awareness that after death we will have to face God and our sins, does make cowards of us all, but he resists conscience. Let my thoughts be bloody or be nothing worth. He knows what his sins are, as he admits to Ophelia. I am very proud, revengeful, ambitious. And she sees what has happened to him, as he has rejected love of her and replaced it with love of justice, of vengeance. Oh, what a noble mind is here o'erthrown. The parallels between Hamlet's action and fate in the Gulf War, indeed any war, or decision to promote justice with violence are many. Let me mention a few. Hamlet starts out with what might be defended as a reasonable political goal, removing a monarch who has taken power illegitimately, like Hussein over Kuwait. But when he has a perfect opportunity to do so, coming upon Claudius praying, the actual tendency of the revenge spirit, the effect of deciding not to be, takes over. And Hamlet decides that he not only wants to kill Claudius, but will wait and do so when he can send him to hell. An Elizabethan audience would have immediately recognized this as a sin, blasphemy. Hamlet presuming rights only God has. And when escalated beyond our originally stated purposes in the Gulf, which were first merely to defend Saudi Arabia, as late as October, all our personnel in the Gulf were given a card saying that was our purpose there, then to liberate Kuwait, then to destroy Hussein's army and government, and even to kill him, we clearly passed a point of presuming beyond what is legitimate, even if our original purposes were proper political goals. President McKay, in his important speech on war in April 1942, specifically renounced trying to change another government as not a legitimate reason for war. When Hamlet strikes Polonius through the curtain, thinking it is the king, Shakespeare shows the inevitable way in which violence, whenever it is used, gets out of hand, misses its targets, strikes down the innocent. Our bombing of an air raid shelter in Baghdad, killing hundreds, no matter how innocent the intent, which was probably to try to wipe out a command post, hopefully with Hussein in it, was a similar example of the uncontrollability of violence once unleashed. A more dramatic and horrifying example is that in destroying the electricity and water supplies of large cities, apparently in an effort to reduce communication to the army and its backup supplies, we destroyed the means of preventing widespread childhood diseases that a U.S. team of doctors predicts will kill 170,000 Iraqi children just this year. Hamlet's growing callousness is another natural result of his decision not to be, and we can see a similar callousness in our own decision not to be in the Gulf. Hamlet says, after killing Polonius, the father of his supposed love, Ophelia, I'll lug the guts into the neighbor room. And after arranging purely out of anger to have Rosencrantz and Guildenstern killed, again without time to repent, so they will go to hell, he says, even though they did nothing to deserve such a fate, they are not near my conscience. Indeed, conscience is the issue here. In 1986, James Kilpatrick, the conservative columnist, argued that Congress should give aid to the Contras and not dally around because of some form of what he called Hamlet's disease. He, like so many who believe against all evidence that force will stop force rather than producing more of it, had misread the play to mean that we shouldn't let our consciences make us think too much, lest it make cowards of us all, and stop us when we might, quote, strike a blow for freedom by bringing down a legitimate government in another country, right? The horrible irony of this is that we now know that about 1 year before that, just as Ronald Reagan was taking his second oath of office to support the Constitution, he was engaged in an illegal, publicly denied program of selling arms to Iran to get money to help the Contras. How's that for conscience? Conscience doesn't make us cowards. Conscience, but embarking upon violence, always tends to destroy conscience and promote bloodthirstiness and just plain moral sleaziness. Let me give a few quick examples of the consequences for a nation of its consistent choice not to be, to engage in fighting for justice, using violence to resist evil, rather than trying to overcome evil with good as God demands. In the 1970s, under Presidents Nixon and Ford, in a program designed by Henry Kissinger and carried out by George Bush, then head of the CIA, we armed the Kurds in Iraq in a specific effort to destabilize Hussein's government, because its competitor Iran under the Shah was then our friend. The Kurds had long been a politically suppressed minority, but this brought the conflict to violence and increasingly severe reprisals by Hussein, eventually the destruction, partly with poison gas, of an entire village. Not only that, but documents had now been uncovered, Bill Moyer's program that you may have seen, proving that we carefully gauged our support, not to bring real independence to the Kurds, because that might bring up the Kurds in Turkey, our ally. We didn't want the Kurds revolting there, even though they're treated as badly as in Iraq, perhaps. Not to bring real independence to the Kurds, but simply to destabilize Hussein somewhat in a controlled way. And that, especially when Iran became our enemy after Khomeini's revolution, and we began to build up our new friend, Iraq, we withdrew our armed support for the Kurds in a way that left them at the mercy of an aroused Hussein. As late as April 1990, only a few months before Hussein invaded Kuwait, U.S. senators, some of them are great hawks that then supported the war, were in Baghdad assuring Hussein that U.S. press criticisms of his treatment of the Kurds were not U.S. policy and that we would continue to sell him weapons and wheat and lend him money to pay for it. Choosing not to be has produced moral decline and inconsistency throughout our government and our nation. Actions that can only be called sleazy, such as the Iran-Contra's arms deal and our involvement in the corrupt BCCI, which you've seen in the paper lately, Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was used to launder money for illegal CIA activities. Choosing not to be rather than active pacifism has produced the moral inconsistency in our treatment of Israel as compared to other Mideast countries, ignoring Israel's invasions and annexations of other nations' territory, their complete disregard of UN resolutions, their consistent refusal of reasonable efforts to negotiate peace with the Arabs. Think of the contrast. What have you seen lately in the paper? Our anguished attempts to get Shamir to budge one little bit. Compare that to for doing what? For annexing land belonging to other sovereign countries, the West Bank, the Golan Heights. When Hussein does it, we refuse to negotiate and send in the army. When Shamir does it, we beg, negotiate, try to negotiate. I don't object to the latter, but on what moral grounds can we be so inconsistent? It has produced the moral inconsistency of our horrified denunciation of the Brezhnev Doctrine. You remember that? Ever hear about the Brezhnev Doctrine? This is it. Russia can provide armed support for regimes and revolutions it likes. Horrible. Horrible idea. And we renounced it. Our government renounced it as evil. And we did. And yet, have you ever heard of the Reagan Doctrine, which we approve of? It reads, America can provide armed support for regimes and revolutions it likes. We denounced as wicked the Russian support of Nicaragua with arms and accused it of evilly supporting El Salvadoran rebels, yet we provided arms to Nicaraguan rebels and continue to do so for the government of El Salvador, whatever atrocities it commits against its people. We called Cuban military support of the Angolan government evil, yet helped arm the rebels, providing landmines that were placed in agricultural fields and killed and maimed hundreds of civilians. Allowing our taxes to be used for such purposes is a consequence of choosing not to be. This moral decline, like Hamlet's, that is perhaps our greatest loss from the Gulf War, was evident from the early war fever, the kick Saddam's butt parties, including one for BYU students, the dehumanizing of Arabs and Muslims, and attacks on war opponents as traitors and by Mormons as heretics during the war, and the incessant parades afterwards. One evidence we lost the war spiritually is our defensive bragging about it, which includes no indication we understand or feel the destruction we wrought upon others and the pain and suffering people in Iraq are still going through, the Kurds who again were aroused by our rhetoric and actions into violent rebellion that has and will cost them dearly, the widows and orphans of tens of thousands of Iraqi soldiers, many still unaccounted for after months of anguish, the children who are dying. After the Civil War, our Civil War, for which there was only one parade, President Abraham Lincoln refused to claim God had been on the Union side, suggesting instead that the war was a punishment for both sides. And he asked that Americans think about the widows and orphans on both sides and bind up the wounds of all with charity for all and malice toward none. We haven't done that. led specifically by a president who wants to prove he's a man, and that we've gotten over the Vietnam syndrome as if the humility and sense of regret we had following that war were a weakness rather than a great strength, the first time in our history that we realized appropriately that we were human and could make mistakes for which we should grieve and repent. I don't mean the abominable treatment of our Vietnam veterans. Their sacrifices should have been rewarded and appreciated, and our proper shame about that war should not have caused us to ignore or abuse them as they came home. The faults for that war, based in our rabid anti-communism and reliance on violence, were not faults of the veterans, but of the politicians who sent them forth to fight. For those politicians to try now to correct, to rectify, the mistakes and shames of Vietnam by sending more soldiers out to fight and then trying to glorify and pray. Let me close with some quotations that may help us do that. One from Shakespeare and one from the Book of Mormon. This from Henry V. Take mercy on the poor souls for whom this hungry war opens his vasty jaws. The widow's tears, the orphan's cries, the dead men's blood, the privy maiden's groans, the for husbands, fathers, and betrothed loves that shall be swallowed in this controversy. This from Mormon, addressed specifically to us. He says, I have seen you, and I know your sins. Addressed specifically to us in the last days, and not addressed to Saddam Hussein and the Iraqis, but to us who have accepted the gospel of Christ. It's about our sins and violence, including, I believe, the widows and orphans we have made in Iraq, where there were other options. Man shall not smite, neither shall he judge, for judgment is mine, saith the Lord. Why do ye suffer the hungry and the needy to pass by you and notice them not? Yea, why do ye build up your secret abominations to get gain and cause that widows should mourn before the Lord, and also orphans to mourn, and the blood of their fathers and their husbands to cry unto the Lord from the ground.
The marvelous things about our religion is that it encourages an intellectual and spiritual reckoning in all things. One of the marvelous things about Eugene England is that he represents all that is praiseworthy about this practice. In my remarks, I wish to follow his example and accordingly will proffer a synthesis of intellectual and spiritual premises that lead me to a conclusion quite different than that reached by Gene. We did not lose the war with Iraq. This conclusion does not imply that I agree with everything that occurred in connection with the war. The arming of Iraq during the Iran-Iraq War, the bloodthirsty slogans seen on campus and in the community, the shabby treatment of those who voiced their opposition to the war, and so on, are all lamentable circumstances. Likewise, my conclusion does not imply that I condone every use of force in which our nation is ever engaged. This having been said, let me first outline the intellectual reasons behind my argument that we did not lose the war with Iraq, and then in the second half of my remarks, I wish to address the very points that Gene has discussed just before I have. I might note that I'm responding to an earlier version of Gene's paper, so some of these remarks will seem, they don't have anything to do with Hamlet. First of all, let me take off a few intellectual reasons. I believe the process of democracy was respected in this instance, and I know that Gene disagrees with me on this point. Throughout the entire period from August to January, there was an extraordinary amount of debate within the nation about what to do in response to the invasion of Kuwait. It's fair to say that Congress, with comfortable majorities, endorsed the president's policy direction, and that even more comfortable majorities in the broader public opinion were manifest. Federal courts ruled that it was not necessary to invoke the War Powers Act. In sum, the action taken by the president can legitimately be said to have reflected the will of the people in this case. Whether that will was right or not, along the lines of Gene's argument, is a separate question. Second, the principles of international law were not only respected, but greatly strengthened by the experience of the Iraq War. The United States went out of its way not to act unilaterally and instead took great pains to court and sway world opinion. The U.S. was successful, as the amazing U.N. Security Council vote authorizing the use of force demonstrates. The world collective security system was enhanced and made more credible, and unlike previous regrettable instances where the U.S. has bypassed the U.N. when it was in our interest to do so, we had neither the need nor the desire to do so in this case. Furthermore, and in accordance with international law, strictly circumscribed objectives guided the military action. There was never any intention to overthrow the government of Saddam Hussein. Third, another point that bears repeating is that Saddam Hussein was a proven threat to regional and world security. Hussein is a man who acts upon his desires to crush all those who oppose him. Instructive in this regard is the interview that the press had with his bodyguard who fled Iraq during after the outbreak of the Iraq War. He gives some interesting details on Saddam Hussein's favorite pastimes. He had a basement in which he liked to personally kill his enemies. His favorite method of doing so was to dip them slowly but into a vat of acid. His second most favorite way of killing his enemies was to strangle them with his bare hands. Hussein has, with his own hands, killed hundreds of individuals, and his policies have killed tens of thousands more. Recent revelations in the press demonstrate that he was intent upon developing usable stores of nerve gas, biological weapons, and atomic weapons. We didn't hit half of Hussein's capabilities in this area, much to the chagrin of Western intelligence. Hussein's potential and his will for mass destruction were both very high. Fourth, the aftermath of the war was not completely disadvantageous. Good did result from this action. Briefly, for the first time in history, all of the major participants in Middle East hostilities have agreed to meet in accordance with the U.S. proposal. I believe the Iraq War had much to do with this reversal. The major exporters of arms to the Middle East have agreed to new protocols to limit the quantity and types of weapons exported and to openly publish what was exported to whom and when. It remains to be seen how effective this regime will be, but its creation is a hopeful sign. The discovery of nerve gas, biological weapons, uranium enrichment plants that were hidden and unknown to Western intelligence, in addition to being strictly forbidden by treaties to which Iraq is a signatory, will prevent these weapons of mass destruction from being produced and from being used. If nothing else, this strengthens the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Authority. However, I feel additional benefits from the standpoint of regional stability will also accrue. And finally, let's not forget, bottom line, Kuwaiti citizens are not being killed, tortured, whatever. This is a good thing, no matter how we feel about their form of government. In my opinion also, the argument that our actions in the Iraq War were inconsistent with our actions or inactions in other parts of the world is unconvincing. Our nation has finite resources to right wrongs in the world. If we were to define a space that represented all the morally right things to do in foreign policy, and if we were to represent a space that represented all the wise things to do in foreign policy from the standpoint of naked self-interest, is it not prudent to first do those things that lie within the intersection of those two spaces? In my opinion, what was done in Iraq is a classic case where the right thing to do and the smart thing to do were one and the same. No wonder we were able to act decisively and wisely there, whereas we have been neither decisive nor wise in other circumstances. If we could not bring ourselves to act given this happy confluence of the two motivations, we could not even aspire to any degree of moral consistency in the future. In sum, then, I feel the ad bellum conditions of just war theory, last resort, legitimate authority, just cause and right intention, chance of success, goal of peace, were all fulfilled. Furthermore, though I do not intend to get into any details, I feel that the conduct of our troops in this war and the strategy employed by the campaign commander were both commendable from a moral standpoint along the lines of just war in bello principles. Interestingly, it was also the first war the U.S. has waged where soldiers were not permitted to drink or visit prostitutes or so forth, which I find to be a noteworthy coincidence. Now, though I find these intellectual reasons to be extremely persuasive, they are insufficient to allow me to wholeheartedly endorse U.S. action in the Iraq War. For that to take place, I must wrestle with the very arguments that Gene raises about the power, and the desirability of active pacifism as a means for conducting foreign relations. I believe that Christ's law, the highest law, is just as Jean says it is. It is the law of active pacifism. I believe that absolutely, and I hope to be able to live by that law in my personal life. Now, how can I square that with my feeling that as a nation it was both right and wise to enter into hostilities with Iraq? Well, I do not believe that Christ's maxims apply to the nation states any more than they do to babies. The nation state, like a baby, is judged according to whether it fulfills the measure of its creation, and it is a very limited measure in each case. A man can live the highest law. Neither a nation state nor a baby can do so. The measure of creation for a nation state is its ability to provide for the survival of the community, without which survival the plan of salvation would be frustrated for its citizens. This is a moral and commendable thing in the sight of the Lord, though the extent of its morality and the extent to which it can be commended is quite limited. Likewise, the measure of creation for a baby is its efforts to ensure its own physical survival. Again, this is a commendable thing in the sight of the Lord, but it is a very limited thing. Part of the purpose of a nation state is to keep the public peace, and the purpose in the world, the system of nation states, is the public arena in which that peace is to be kept. DNC section 134, verse 8, can be applied internationally as well as intranationally. We believe that the commission of crime should be punished according to the nature of the offense, that murder, treason, robbery, theft, and the breach of the general peace in all respects should be punished according to their criminality and their tendency to evil among men by the laws of that government in which the offense is committed. And for the public peace and tranquility, all men should step forward and use their ability in bringing offenders against good law to punishment. Now, does this mean there is no hope for peace? Does this mean we are locked into war with no hope that active pacifism can become the guiding principle of community action? No, I don't think so. Yet there is a very specific process that must be followed before active pacifism can guide a community. We know how it is to guide an individual life. How is it to guide a community? If we elected an active pacifist as president tomorrow, could we reap the blessings of active pacifism? I think not. The process is not an outside-in one. As with everything that counts in the gospel, it is an inside-out one. The evolution of the nation-state cannot be imposed from without. It must grow from within as a natural consequence of the increasing righteousness of every individual citizen. As that righteousness builds and grows, the nation state will wither away just as surely as a butterfly sheds its cocoon, just as surely as a baby grows into a man. Then and only then will security matters be handled as they were in the time of Enoch. This is from Moses chapter 7, verse 13. And so great was the faith of Enoch that he led the people of God, and their enemies came to battle against them. And he spake the word of the Lord, and the earth trembled, and the mountains fled, even according to his command, and the rivers of water were turned out of their course, and the roar of the lions was heard out of the wilderness, and all nations feared greatly. So powerful was the word of Enoch, and so great was the power of the language which God had given him. Enoch could not have led in this fashion if his people were not as righteous as he. Christ cannot reign on this earth until after a great sifting has left only those who are capable of forming Zion. There is a law upon which the blessings of active pacifism in a community setting are based, and this law cannot be wished or intellectualized away. Until that time when we shed the nation state, we cannot wish away nation state type behavior. Until that time when we are no longer a child, we cannot wish away childlike behavior. And so, in the interim, as we live within our constraints as a community and we attempt to do so, let us do so as well as we are able. In the lesser sphere in which we live, force can be related to moral ends. We did not lose the Iraq War. Not only did we not lose it, but we provided an example of how to do it well in this lesser sphere. I only pray that the time swiftly approaches when we need not do it, well or otherwise, at all. That, of course, depends upon each and every one of us.
I would again like to thank Professor England and Professor Hudson for their excellent intellectual and spiritual analysis of the war with Iraq. It's almost 3 o'clock. If you'd like to field any questions, the next session starts at 3:15, so you're more than welcome to stay as long as you'd like, but there is another session at 3:15.
Can I just take 1 minute, and then I'll take some questions, or Valerie can.
I think I have the same goal as Valerie. I guess I'm just less pessimistic about our ability to move in that direction and have our government lead us in that direction. If she's right, and I think she is, that it must be from the inside out, the way that happens is to be led in that direction. I think the reason we lost the war in the Gulf is that we were led in a different direction, that our president did not use his opportunities to build righteousness in us or teach us the principles of active pacifism, but just the absolute opposite of that. And that's what worries me, is that we can't, I hate to think that we have to wait for Christ to come in some kind of force and destroy the tares, and then only the righteous who are left somehow will be able to live these principles. As I understand the 46th section, the goal of Zion is one we can all share, and we can move towards that. And it specifically states, as you know, that the defining condition of those who will be able to live in Zion will be those who will not take up the sword against each other. Everybody else will. That's a perfect description of what Gerard's talking about, that we live in a world of violence. Any entrance into it is an entrance into an area which is self-perpetuating and cyclical. And until we refuse to be part of it, we can't separate ourselves out from it or stop it. And if we're going to move in the direction that I agree with Valerie, we must, I think we've got to take some steps towards it. Interestingly enough, the First Presidency, despite her insistence that there is no connection, has told us there is. They told us very clearly in their statement of Christmas 1981, to all who seek a resolution to conflict, be it a misunderstanding between individuals or an international difficulty among nations, we commend the Council of the Prince of Peace. Now, I admit that it's hard. It's interesting she used the example of babies. And if Charlotte will forgive me, my wife, I'd like to suggest that she's a living example to me, who am naturally a violent person, a person who believes in justice and responds that way, that it can be done with babies. She's a great, great grandmother, unique in my experience, and the reason is she lives the principle of active pacifism with children. And most of us as parents don't even do that. And to me, she's an evidence that not only nations, but even babies who may be harder than nations, can be brought to a remarkable degree of pacifism in their own hearts and with each other at a very early age by someone who's willing to set an example and live with them those principles on their level, to get down on the ground with them and live that level. I don't see us as a nation setting that kind of example. What does it mean to say that we can move righteously towards international law and that we've increased the chances of doing so in this recent war, when we obviously still think it's perfectly all right for us to walk into Panama or walk into Grenada to serve our purposes, to perform aggression against other nations despite international law, even against the dictates of international law, and then turn around and say we're now supporting it because somehow it helps us out? We've got to start being consistent in our own aggression, and I think with all aggressions. But now let's hear from you. I'm sorry we took so long. You had your hand up first in the back.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
I'm challenging the idea that large groups of people can't act with morality.
Oh, I'm sorry if you felt that was my premise. The question was questioning the premise that large groups cannot act in a moral fashion. Is that it?
You said that large groups are limited to looking out for their own best interests.
No, I believe that that's a pretty good explanation of a lot of the behavior we see in the world. But I do not believe that that is some sort of ironclad constraint on us. In fact, I hope that we are moving towards fulfilling the law upon which active pacifism in a community setting can, in fact, guide us. I do not believe that we're at that point. I think that Gene makes a good point that there's room for good leadership as somebody up there on the hill pointing the way. But something very important about the fact that the majority of people in this country did in fact back the hostilities against Iraq. It means that we're not there yet. Even if we had had an active pacifist president, I do not believe that that would have changed the substantive opinion of the majority of people in this country. So we must move on an individual basis. And when I teach my national security course, I try to leave my students with something that may seem rather paradoxical, but something that Ezra Taft Benson said. He said that every single one of us can do something to increase the national security of the United States of America. Do you know what that is? To live a righteous life. Right? Do you think we should follow it up, or should we have other questions? Is that a relative of yours?
Don't call on my son.
What I
want to
know is
that
you are saying, I agree with your point.
Good. Are you sure you're related to Gene? You know, it's. Let me give you an analogy.
No, just
answer. No, well. Okay.
That sounds awfully aggressive.
Well, I'll give you a metaphor, and it's hard for me to wrestle with this because, you know, deep down inside, I actually believe a lot of what your father says. But I think we only differ on nuance a lot more than we differ on substance. But to me, it's like you take a beautiful rosebud. You want to see the rose. You want to have it here right now. And you know what you do? You start pulling down the petals. What do you get? You don't get what you want. And I think it's the same thing in this instance. As much as we would like to pretend that the city of Enoch can be here in the United States right now, August 10th, 1991, guess what? It ain't here. Okay? And we must learn to cope with that. That is to say, we must learn to understand what it is we can do well, morally, and rightly now. And then we must look with bright hope and with a lot of zeal and with a lot of effort on our own part to the day when the city of Enoch can come down from heaven and live in the midst of us. It's going to be a process. It's not going to happen overnight. And we must learn to live with the beginning of that process as well as with the end of that process.
Can I just suggest two specific things, and you have an influence because you vote for people, that would be part of the process right now. One of the reasons for our fighting, as Valerie clearly pointed out, it's because moral rightness and national self-interest came together here. What was the national self-interest? Oil.
Atomic weapons.
Yeah, atomic weapons. But oil was certainly part of it. Are you aware that two of the chief supporters of the war in the Gulf are Mormon senators, Garn and Hatch, 6 months before voted against a requirement of increasing the gas mileage of American cars that it would remove most of our need for Mideast oil?
Nonsense.
Well, all right. It's nonsense, but I can show you the figures. The point is, whether it's absolutely right or not, the point is, there are things we can do now. Whether it could have removed all of our need or not, the point is it could have removed a good part of it. And the question is, are we willing to sacrifice? I believe that active pacifism can only operate if we're willing to sacrifice. The Marshall Plan was a sacrifice. We used money that justifiably we could have used for our own purposes to help an enemy. If we had had a Marshall Plan after the First World War, I firmly believe we would not have had the Second World War. Instead, we exacted reparations and vengeance upon Germany and set the grounds where Hitler got the support he needed. We couldn't have done away with a Hitler that way, but we could have done away, I think, with the support that enabled him to do what he did. And it took a sacrifice for Anwar Sadat to do what he did. We're not willing to sacrifice. We want to have our national interest. We want to move in some easy way towards the city of Enoch, but not to make any sacrifices. What if we had to pay the price for greatly reduced use of oil? Are we willing to do it? I think we're not. And we don't have leaders, including our Mormon leaders, who are willing to ask that sacrifice of it. And the result is we do trade blood for oil. Not our blood, but the Iraqi blood. And we will trade other blood in the Middle East, I believe, if we continue this process.
I've already got time enough showing my paper that I sent you.
The point is, it seems to me, that Lowell Bunyan uses a great Buddhist proverb to make, to action alone thou hast a right, not to its results. Christ doesn't say, if you live my commandments, everything will be wonderful, and you will be happy, and you will never have any problems. He says, live my commandments. My contention is the evidence of history is that when we don't live His commandments, the results are perfectly obvious again and again. We produce cycles of violence that go on and on and on. On the other hand, the few times we do, and I mentioned the two, the results are perfectly obvious. Why don't we have faith enough to try it more? And I'm saying, I'm not sure I can guarantee the results. I'm not an expert in international relations. I don't know exactly what will happen if we do certain things, but it seems to me clear enough that Christ is telling us what we should do. Overcome evil with good. Now, that seems to me absolutely clear. I don't see any gray about it. What is good? Violence is not good. Inconsistency is not good. Purely following our self-interest in ways that absolutely deny our actions in one place in terms of consistency with another is not good. I think that's clear. What are some good things? I think there are lots of good things. I think working in the way President Bush did through the UN to build consensus and to work out regional problems peacefully is very good. Why do we have to continue on to violence? I think insisting that Israel follow the same mandates we make to Iraq is good, and we should withdraw our money until they do. And I think they would. I really believe that. But we don't. Why don't we? Because we have a large lobby or whatever. Our senators depend on. We're not willing to sacrifice, in other words, to live consistently and morally at a level that I think we could. I don't think we have to be perfect. I don't think we have to be perfectly Christ-like. I'm certainly not. But I'm convinced on the examples of history, what Christ tells us again and again throughout all the scriptures, and Charlotte, that we can create peace in the world.
We better stop. Barbara Holgerson just announced that because there's not another session immediately following this one, that you can stay as long as you'd like, if they're willing to answer your questions. So
the plenary session is at 3:15 over there.
There is a plenary session at 3:15, so if you're planning on going that, you may want to head over. But you can stay here as long as you'd like until they say that's enough.
But that would be a sacrifice. We can't do that.
Go ahead.
Our economy would suffer. Okay. Well, the question for the tape essentially is, what about a case during World War II where a pacifist admitted that although his actions were pacifistic, he had to help the French underground, because things had gone that so far in that situation, there was no other way to deal with it. I think in that instance he was probably right. Although I am an absolute pacifist in theory, I support the beginnings of the Second World War as a case where, given the conditions, I think if we had started earlier, and that's always the question with active pacifism, it's always posed at people when it is too late. Well, what would you do now? And I'd say, well, I'd start a lot earlier. But if you say, all right, what would you do